You're listening to No Plot, Only Lore, a podcast about games and the tables we play them at. Your DMs tonight, and every night, are Josh and Chris. You can find us on all podcast platforms, or check us out at noplotonlylore.com. If you like what you hear today, please rate and review the show, and share it with everyone you've ever met. Welcome back to No Plot, Only Lore, Northern Alberta's favorite D&D podcast. My name is Christopher, and I'm sitting here with Josh as usual, and we both watched some Shogun.
I finally binged it in a day and a half. But yeah, I went hard 1 week.
Same. I watched the first two episodes on a Thursday night, and then that Friday night I stayed up until 4:30 in the morning finishing it.
I started one episode on like a Thursday night, ironically, at like 11 p.m. I was like, I'll just watch one episode, see if it's any good. And then I watched two episodes. I was like, oh, you sons of... I have to stop this and go... I have to go to work early tomorrow. And then that's all I thought about for 2 days until I finally watched it all on Saturday. That was...
Yeah, it's too bad it was so terrible. Like, what a shitty show. Why did we even subject ourselves to that?
Yeah, I don't know why everyone's talking about how hype and cool and good it is.
Right? Possibly because it's hype and cool and good.
It's very hype and cool and good.
It's so good.
Man, if you like all of the like politically stuff from Game of Thrones without it being stupid, then this is the show for you.
And I really do. Like, that is absolutely some of my favorite stuff in Game of Thrones, or really just like any big political thriller. Just like getting into the nitty gritty politics of the things and like who has an alliance with whom and how you're going to set up that alliance and this person betrayed me and like all of that shit is just so compelling for me.
The maneuvering and the like, oh, well, you know, this person's working with this person, but maybe you can go behind their back and chat them up and suddenly they won't be engaged anymore or whatever. Like it's a whole thing. And watching someone like here's what it sort of made me feel like. I love like that Ocean's 11-y type like heist movie where it's like, here's the thing we're doing. And then we're going to show you all of the cool things we did to set that up that you weren't paying attention to along the way. Right. And I get that feeling several times in this show where it's like, oh, here's this twist, but here's what I was doing that actually set that up because, you know, you didn't know. Like, not, like, specifically like that, because it's not a heist movie for sure, but, like, it gave that same feeling of, like, actually, I was a genius the whole time. Here's my master plan.
But I think my favorite character, because of specifically that vibe, I don't remember any of the characters' names in this show. I wrote down, like, two of them. But the guy with the feathers on... shitty little guy that's, like, playing both sides.
Yeah, okay, first of all, that character I hated, like, right off the bat, because they're like, oh, this guy's a piece of shit. And then he's kind of always a piece of shit, but, like, in an honorable way sometimes.
Never really sure.
Yeah, he goes back, like, I think that's probably the brilliant thing about the guy playing him, is that, like, he manages to get you to like this piece of shit. And then every once in a while, he rug pulls you where he's like, oh, remember, I'm garbage.
And you're like, boiling a human.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, just to set the stage there, this is a person who has boiled another human being to death.
Episode one.
In front of episode one. Establishing the stakes of who this character is.
The
will boil you for, like, philosophical endeavors.
Yeah. His first act that establishes the character is... boy, am I obsessed with the moment of death. Let's find out what happens when we kill a guy this way. And then you kind of forget he did that halfway through. Because he's, like, kind of a good uncle. And, like...
right? And except when he isn't. When he's like a really bad uncle.
Yeah.
But, like, he's a really bad uncle in a way that you kind of empathize with.
Yeah.
Right? Where it's just, like, how could you give me this thing when it's been mine all the time? Like, I think everybody has one of those relatives in their life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
where it's just like, yeah, you can't give me this because it was already mine, you douche.
Yeah, it's right? Like, you only exist at my, like, good graces.
Yeah. I brought you into this world and I can take you out of it.
Yeah.
He didn't. He was an uncle. But, like, same vibes.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the kind of shitty dad vibes. But, yeah, no, that actor was superb.
Yeah.
Because, like, I literally never actually had an idea of where his loyalties were.
Yeah, you go back and forth between, like, oh, he's a shitbag who's, like, betraying our favorite superhero. And then it's like, oh, no, maybe he's a double agent? I don't know what's going on. And then you're kind of, at the end of the day, you're kind of just like, oh, it's just like a dude living in the middle, just praying to God he can, like, get through it and make the best end for himself. And he doesn't really have a plan. He's just kind of, like, he's just bouncing from, like, you know, what he perceives as strength to strength, hoping to side with the eventual winner by not, like, well, really, like, picking a side.
So much of it is just that, right? Where it's like, I don't know who is going to win, and I'm pretty sure that either one of these sides is going to end in my suffering and death.
Yeah.
The fuck am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
Right? And he's just kind of, like, pantsing it the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it's brilliant, and it's brilliantly acted, and it's brilliantly written, and I loved his entire arc.
Yep.
And I liked basically every arc except for Jack Blackthorne.
Oh, right. Yeah. He's... Blackthorne is, I find, really annoying. Because he, first of all, his stupid face, where he just kind of looks like... No, like, he spends the whole show with this kind of bewildered idiot look on his face. Even, like, in his moments when he's supposed to be at his, like, most, like, intelligent and conniving and strong, he just kind of looks like a deer in the headlights. Which I understand, like, maybe he was trying to communicate, like, a stranger in a strange land, you know, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you'd think after a while he would sort of settle in a little bit. And maybe it's just the guy's face. Like, honestly, it might just be the actor's face and there's nothing he could do about it. But it annoyed me after a while where it's like, man, like, you realize you have a little bit of authority existing at this, you know, dude's service. Like, maybe stick to it.
I know the comparison has been made by others, but to me, he always looked a little bit like Tom Hardy in Venom. In Venom.
Yeah.
Right, where, like, there's something going on that is completely beyond his comprehension. He's just along for the ride.
Yeah.
And it didn't help that there's a physical resemblance.
Yeah, that's definitely not working in his favor, because he never gets to turn into an alien and bite the head off any samurai.
I mean, maybe in the second season.
if there's from the sounds of things, there's not going to be a second season, which is really disappointing. I want to see more of, like, the brilliant strategist plan play out as he moves forward.
I think it makes a lot of sense to leave it as a single miniseries and then maybe do other miniseries set in the same place and time.
Just give, like, us one big battle. Like, we never got one big cool fight.
Like, I get that it would be very difficult to do that in this world, right? Like, not the big fight, but, like, coming back to it in another miniseries.
Right,
like,
right.
This world was specifically created as a, like, historical fiction about the Sengoku Jidai era of Japan, where we're, like, slowly unifying the clans under, like, a couple of major powers. But, like, the author filed off all the serial numbers and changed everybody's names and changed some of the situations that were around it. And so, like, doing a continuation of this, if you're not doing a direct sequel, would be really hard.
Yeah. It's, like, don't get me wrong. I think it's a very good way to, like, some of the best writing comes when you're like, hey, I didn't write this. This is just what happened. And that whole era is just, like, Looney Tunes over the top, weird. Like, I don't think there's any, maybe this is my ignorance of world history, but I don't think there's any other, like, extended period of time in any other, like, global setting that had as much weirdness as the Warring States era. Like, it...
I mean, yeah, there are. There are, like, a few eras in European history. Like, the Hundred Year War and, like, all of the wackiness that got into that. Like, a bunch of the Succession Wars, War of the Roses, that kind of bullshit. And, like, African history gets nutty. There are a bunch of, like, really cool things that happen over the course of, like, a few major empires in Africa where, like, there is shit happening all the time. And then because the empires no longer exist and because colonialism and imperialism, a lot of that history has been swept away. We don't necessarily hear about a lot of it.
Right.
Like the Bantu empires early on, we saw like empires rising and falling. It felt like every decade, right? Like you would have a new ruler show up and like consolidate a bunch of people under him. And then suddenly that empire would disappear and like two others would show up where that one used to be. Right, and it was really chaotic and tumultuous, but like also super interesting.
Yeah, but isn't that more like rises and falls like within a larger like empire, and not just like several strong empires are sort of like dicking with each other for decades?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that makes that era in Japan so interesting is how codified it was.
Right, right.
Like all of the very firmly drawn lines and the like clearly recorded alliances and
yeah
the, like levels of intrigue that were happening
and the documentation was, of it all.
Oh yeah, no, like meticulous.
Which is just wild, like how, because so that's the thing that like comes up all the time. It's like, well, history is written by the victors, except in this case it's like history was actually written by the historians and they kept careful records the whole time. And it doesn't matter if you won, because you're going to tell people what really happened. And you still won, but they know you were a dick about it.
Well, and I think one of the other interesting things is that, like, history is written by the victors, but the victor kept changing.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, everybody was winning a little bit here and there. And you didn't necessarily get, like, the full history of what was going on for the clans that ended up losing hard.
Yeah.
But you would still have their records that you could look back on. And a lot of those were also meticulously kept in, like, archives and, like, the imperial histories and that sort of thing. So, like, really cool how deep into the history that you can get into that era. And it's also so intimidating. Because, like, Tokugawa Ieyasu had, like, 13 names?
Yeah.
over the course of like a few decades, he changed his name a lot.
There's a lot to keep track of.
And like, he's not the only one. It was just like this whole,
yeah,
like it was a bit of a fashion statement to every few years, update your name to something that's even cooler and more badass than the name you had before.
I hate to make the comparison, but it sounds like they're like Warhammer custodies who just like wind up with like this long string of 32 battle honorific names that wrap around their armor because they've been fighting for centuries.
Well, I mean, the big thing was that you didn't keep your old one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, it was just kind of understood that Tokugawa was part of the Matsudaira clan, and so he had, like, a few names that started with Matsudaira. But, like, once he was Tokugawa, and nobody really, like, did it, that's what he's recorded in, as in the histories now. So,
yeah that's anyway. That's a funny thing that happens, like, throughout a bunch of historical things, where like the contemporaries at the time just assume you will know something that's like super yeah. common knowledge, and then 100 years down the road, everyone's like, "What the hell is this?" So that's
one of the interesting things about trying to get like the history of commoners.
Yeah,
right? Like the. I'm not a historian by no. trade, and I feel like that's important to note, but I did do a fair amount of art history in my schooling, And so one of the things that we can do in art history that we can't really do in written history is get an idea of what the lives of commoners were like, because nobody wanted to write about the lives of commoners,
right,
for the most part.
Yeah, why would you? They're common.
But like in a bunch of the like written information that we do have about commoners, they'll occasionally mention something that we just have like no touchstones for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They'll be like, oh yeah, and of course, you know, they were using the Fergen flop, and you're like,
The who and the what now? Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like marginalia. I actually wrote an essay about marginalia in religious documents.
Okay.
Because occasionally when you're flipping through these religious documents, you'll find like a picture of a rabbit riding a snail with a lance jousting another rabbit who has the face of like Saint Peter, who's riding a different rabbit.
Okay.
Right. And like, they're, again, very codified, right?
Right.
We know what St. Peter is supposed to look like in these documents because there were, like, very clearly written instructions from the Catholic Church of this is what St. Peter looks like.
Yeah.
And so, like, those icons were used with these, like, weird little cartoons of, like, rabbits and snails fighting each other.
Yeah.
And we don't know why.
Yeah.
There was, like, a rash of this that happened in the 14th and 15th century, where like every single holy manuscript that we're looking at has these little doodles in the margins, and we have no idea what they mean. They're like memes from that era.
Really?
It would be like finding a picture of sad Keanu in a historical document, having no idea who Keanu is or why he's sad.
Like, that's very funny to me.
It's the fucking best. So I ended up writing like an entire, like 7 or 8 page paper on that marginalia because I think it's amazing.
That's so hilarious. I was going to say, like, I know there's a fairly recent thing where they discovered this, like a, essentially like a D12 with spikes on it from like Pompeii or something. And they couldn't figure out what the hell it was for. They just like, they thought like, oh, maybe it's like, for like gambling, or they just threw out all these ideas, and then like some grandma saw it and was like, oh, that's like a, I guess it's like a jig for knitting, where you're just like, hey, this little thing is really handy for starting like the tip of a glove on a finger, like the finger of the fingertip of a glove. And like no one had any context for it, but, and they don't really like make them anymore, but somehow she just like knew.
Well, they don't necessarily make them anymore, but she still probably uses one.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably just made one at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few things like that. Like I recall that there were like some carpentry tools that were found as well that had kind of a similar story, where like none of the scholars could figure out what these things were for, but the carpenters who were working like a few doors down had tools that were incredibly similar because they just, they never changed them. They're the same tools.
At any rate, we don't want this to just devolve into an episode of Extra History. Go check out their excellent video series on the Sengoku Jidai. But the whole subject of Shogun got us talking about the idea of incorporating real-world history into our campaigns. I know we'd previously talked about the idea of discussing, like, underutilized settings, and I think some historically accurate, or at least historically different ones are, well, you know, like accuracy implies that we're going to try to follow some sort of, like, preconceived correct timeline or whatever. At least you could set it in, like, you know, Warring States era China or you know, Japan or historical European whatever, and follow accuracy to the time period without following like the actual history, if that makes sense.
Like, yeah, it does. I think the one thing that I always kind of want to avoid whenever I'm doing something that's like actually historical, and I don't do it very often, right? Like a lot of the time I'm doing like alternate history, or I'm doing like a inspired by that time frame idea.
Yeah.
But like when I'm doing something that's actually historical, one of the things that I really want to avoid is somebody else being the main characters.
Right. Right.
So like it's one of the problems that I end up having when I'm dealing with like products that come out of adaptation as well. Mm-hmm. So like I have a copy of the Wheel of Time role-playing game from Wizards of the Coast, and it's really good.
Yeah.
I think that the system itself is really well made. But it's really hard to play knowing that Randall Thor is out there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And so you can play 20 years before Rand, but then you also have to think like, is anything that I'm doing actually affecting stuff?
Right.
Right. Like, is anything that I'm playing with here going to have an impact in the future when I already know what the future could be?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So like you kind of have to work your characters into the history or the setting of the thing in a way that allows them to be the main characters. I think one of the best versions that I've seen of this is actually the Star Wars movie where they go and get the plans.
Right. Rogue One.
What was that one called? Yeah, Rogue One. Because like they are the main characters, and this is a like an important thing that happened that we haven't really discussed before.
Definitely.
So it makes it really easy to like work in a new cast of characters that we know does have an impact in the future, but we've never actually heard anything about these people before in the past.
Right. Right.
So
you're exploring details about it, but you know that there's like an ending that's coming or some major event that you just can't avoid.
Yeah. And I think in some ways the amount of detail that we have in the Sengoku Jidai works against that a little bit. Where there are other areas of history where we don't have nearly as much information, where your player characters can really fill in those gaps.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Like one that we keep coming back to is like first century Middle East.
Okay.
Dealing with like very early Christianity and the like Roman Empire and like that area of the world. We don't know a lot about what was happening there. Like we have some ideas, we have some historical records, but there is a lot of space for people to be doing cool shit.
Yeah.
In that era. Without having to like worry that Jesus is out there somewhere doing all the cool stuff instead of you.
And like, don't get me wrong. I think if I was to use a setting like that, I may reference things that are happening. Like, you always hear tales of a weirdo from Bethlehem who's, you know, just apparently walked across the lake in the middle of a storm. You're like, oh, weird. Right?
Seems like it might be important later. Let's put a pin in that.
Interesting. It's, you know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Mm.
Where, like, you're aware that all of this is happening at the same time as actual Jesus is around. And it's... right? And it's just like, oh, it's just, like, over there. Just a better version of what we're doing over here.
Yeah. I don't know that I would. I think that, like, there's enough cool stuff happening in that era that I don't think we necessarily need to bring in like a hard timeline on stuff that's happening in the Bible.
Oh, sure, like, sure, sure.
There's so much room in like just that region and in the Roman Empire and in Northern Africa and what's happening in Greece, right? Like, so much is tumultuous and strange, but nobody has like firm details on it, that it would be really easy to just like do a Greco-Roman heist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, steal the Athena Parthenos.
You could have a bunch of gladiators stage a breakout from their like low-level shit gladiator school.
I am Spartacus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, hey,
maybe don't steal that one wholesale. But
my brain was Templar. I remembered I saw something today where someone made the claim that the Romans, like, there's no white people in the Bible.
There are not,
except kind of the Romans. And then they said, sorta? They said the Romans didn't exist back then.
What?
There was no.
I would like you to. Is there backup information to that? Like,
nope.
Did they have an art? Oh,
nope. That was just their statement. There weren't Romans at the time of Jesus.
So I feel like they did not read the same book I did.
I don't think they read it at all.
Because, they made a pretty big showing.
They may have had something to do with the death of our Lord and Savior.
Like right in the middle of that book, there's, like, a real big showing of Romans for a while. Like, I get that, like, the first chunk of it, there was a bunch of stuff going on in Egypt, but, like, towards the middle, there was a lot of Roman stuff going on.
I will say...
And then that just kept going.
Specifically in, like, the Jesus lore section of the Bible, just straight up starts with the Romans being like, hey, everyone, we need to figure out how many of you there are.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's why they went to Bethlehem.
Yeah, and there was that whole thing with, like, a Roman officer's wife wanting the head of some, like, dirty river preacher.
Oh, you mean John the Baptist?
Yeah, that guy.
the guy who baptized Jesus?
I mean, that's probably important. Spoiler warning, I guess. But yeah, just like that. I feel like they made a pretty hefty showing at the beginning of the Jesus lore section.
They pop up early and often as, I will say, a pretty important antagonist in the whole story of Jesus, etc.
Although, if you, like, fast forward a couple hundred years, they really pick up that protagonist torch on the whole Christian thing.
They pick it up, like, right away. Like...
Yes and no.
Well, I'd say within, like, what, like, maybe 100 years? They're like, Jesus, right. Sorry about all the, like, flaying and boiling in oil and all that other upside down crucifixion and stuff like that. We love these guys. Like, sorry.
It isn't really until Constantine that they're like, we love these guys. Sorry.
I suppose. But there's early signs.
But Constantine is really like, he's gung ho for it. Like there's.
Well, I guess that's where you got to distinguish between like the Roman Empire, like the Holy Roman Empire, and like who's.
Yeah.
Does it count as the same empire? You know?
I mean, no.
like legally, no. Spiritually, kind of, yes.
But this is what I'm saying, right? Like, there's so much, like, wiggle room going on. And, like, if we fast forward 70 years after the crucifixion of Jesus.
Right.
There is... so much room to do weird shit in the Middle East.
Yeah, you could be a sect of secret Christians who are avoiding the Roman government.
With, like, one Roman mole that happens to be all up in your biz.
Right?
Like, recent converts who don't really know what they're doing or how they're supposed to do it, and they need to get information from somebody who does, and the nearest person who knows that stuff is far away.
Or one of you still works at their job for the Romans. Has to dodge that every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not even to mention just like the non Christian stuff that was happening
sure.
at that time, where you've just got like all of the Roman era nonsense that's happening, like even still with the Hellenistic, like the late Hellenistic religious stuff that's happening. People are throwing bacchanals, you've still got like a tremendous amount of like trade that's happening. All of the Roman campaigns that are happening across the continent of Europe. Like, there's so much room to play in that era that I think it's kind of a shame that we've never actually taken a harder look at it in a role-playing game, or like multiple role-playing games.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's one of many eras. I mean, like, you want to talk about, let's just stay on theme, other civilizations that appear in the Bible. Like, there's lots of stuff could be done in all versions of Egypt for a long time. There's there's so many Egypts that you can basically set it anywhere over the period of a couple thousand years. And
my favorite idea for a campaign that I haven't had a chance to do yet is Egyptian Indiana Jones.
In ancient Egypt?
Yes. So ancient Egypt has a bunch of archaeologists who are studying ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
Like ancienter Egypt from like 1500 years ago. And you have to go on like some tomb plundering, like whip snapping adventure in ancient Egypt.
What's that goofy fact that always gets brought up? Like Cleopatra lives closer to now than the construction of the pyramids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the pyramids were constructed when people were still hunting mammoths.
Yeah.
Right, like that. We don't really have an appreciation for how incredibly fucking old Egypt is.
Yeah,
it goes way back. So yeah, like the ability to.
Oh,
like,
I do want to point out they were not hunting mammoths in Egypt.
No, it was a little warm there for the mammoths, but way up north.
Yeah, yeah.
Still had some groups that were hunting mammoths. But yeah, like the idea of playing like some new kingdom archaeologists working for Pharaoh to try and unlock the secrets of the ancient tombs is brilliant.
Yeah, why not set your like, you know, horror movie one shot with mummies in Egypt? In Egypt. With a bunch of Egyptians, like,
The wiggle room that you have there, right? Like all of the stuff that we have about those eras of Egypt, like we have a lot of information about what it was like to be a commoner or like one of the slaves in Egypt, but it's all coming secondhand from the nobility, right? Like the people who are actually like carving this shit into stone.
Yeah.
And so like, there's so, so much wiggle room for like what you could be getting up to as like a librarian.
Yeah.
Right. You're just like a normal person who has to go on a weird, like, cataloging adventure for some reason. Or, like, even later in Egypt, when we start looking at, like, the Mycenaean Empire, like the early Greek, earliest versions of the like, Hellenistic Greeks, the interactions with, like, those folks, or, go way, way further back in like the very beginnings of Egypt and like the idea of settling the Nile and like the crazy adventures that are going to happen in like northern Africa as you're trying to carve out a place to live in what could be both very supportive but also incredibly dangerous territory.
Yeah.
Just there's so much room in Egypt to make cool fucking stories. And we end up with like the Shabalhiri Roach.
Yeah.
Which we wanted to call the Lisan El Gaib Roach.
I can't keep the name of it straight in my head, but all of, yeah. The Lisan El Gaib Roach. I heard myself misremember it on a previous episode. And I was like, that's even worse. I'll just call it something funny. Lisan El Gaib. But yeah, obviously, you know, ancient Hellenic areas, you know, Roman, Egyptian. You could even do like there's lots of historical settings you could do, like something in North America where the party of braves goes off to hunt down the Wendigo that's been stealing kids from the tribe, you know, or
fucking Prey. I know you haven't got a chance to watch it yet, but it is so good.
Oh yeah, yeah. I love a Predator movie. I just haven't had a time to watch a movie. Because I'm either not watching TV at all or binging Shogun for 6 hours. there's no in between.
That is exactly the kind of shit that I would love to see in a like First Nations role-playing game.
Yeah.
Where you have like a good representation of the peoples.
Yeah.
And also presenting a difficult challenge that they are provided the opportunity to intelligently solve.
Yeah.
Right. And that I think is what really like shone through for that movie for me was like there is a tendency in Hollywood to represent the First Nations as being very stereotypical.
Yeah. It's that whole like noble, savage, stupid thing that they do all the time.
Yeah, and I felt that this movie did a really good job of getting away from that.
Yeah.
Right. And presenting the characters as complex people who have goals of their own and are intelligently attempting to achieve those goals, utilizing the tools that they have at their disposal.
Yeah.
And it was fucking brilliant. It was great.
Yeah.
10 out of 10, no notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well done, Prey.
Yeah, so I mean, there's, you know, obviously if people are more familiar and comfortable with it, doing stuff, like you said, in that, like, in the sub-Saharan Africa, the one I thought of was, like, not to, like, promote a problematic movie maker, but, like, Apocalypto really fired my imagination for, like, what could you do set in, like, an ancient Aztec or Incan, setting? Because, like, I got down a bit of a rabbit hole, mostly because of a board game. Teotihuacan made me do a bit of a deep dive on just like the weird political history of what was going on in South and Central and America before the Spanish got there. And there is history that we can study and know about, like the weird stories of like the political landscape there. And it doesn't all have to be like, ha ha ha, running around the jungle, watch out for jaguars, right?
Well, and like, one of the other fun things about South America is that, like, I can't remember if it was the Incans or the Mayans, but one of the empires that we often look at as being like the ancient past is younger than Oxford.
Yeah.
Right, so like, there is so much history and so much archaeology that we still haven't done in those areas.
Yeah,
that like again, you have so much room to play, right? You have so much room to like build into those areas and create interesting stories there.
Yeah, I mean, well, and frankly, there's unexplored history in old like United Kingdom, like old Scotland, old like Celtic Ireland, like there's
people trying to figure out like the historicity of the Arthur myths.
Yeah.
Right. Like there are still a lot of people who are actively trying to find the historical precedent for those legends.
Yeah.
And like there's been some really good books. I can't remember the name of the guy. It was like Jack White or something. Wrote a series of novels that were treatments of Arthur as a Roman centurion.
Yeah.
In Britain.
That's just awesome because like it ties in just like in my mind, it ties two flavors of history together, you know?
Yeah. And kind of tries to reconcile the idea of like an ancient Arthur with the historical fact of a Roman Britain.
Yeah.
Right. And from what I understand, they were very good. I only got about halfway through the first one My ex-wife took the books with her.
Oh,
well. So I still have to like find those ones, but that's not this kind of podcast. So, well, yeah, like the Arthurian legends, might have some historicity going on there, but like doing a Roman Britain, doing pre-Roman Celtic Britain would be great. Doing Gallic France would be a blast. Like, again, not to like stereotype or anything, but I absolutely think there's room for an Asterix and Obelix.
Yeah.
Just like some silly Gallic shenanigans fighting against the Roman Empire.
Yeah. And then at the end of every session, they all drink a potion and run out of the village to go beat the crap out of the Romans.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So let's shift gears for a second here. Like, obviously we've talked about a bunch of different settings, but what do we want to give people like some guidelines for how best to like actually incorporate whatever setting they choose into a campaign? Like, are you concerned at all about like the respectfulness or whatever of the way they're approaching the setting? Like, to my mind, I would be hesitant to set anything in an era as like just a dumb joke.
Right.
And I'm also like, I'm not that familiar with like, let's say like the Zulu Empire. I'm not going to set something in there just because like it sounds cool.
It does sound cool though.
It does sound cool, but I won't set anything there until I've like done the homework. But is there anything better we can give as a guideline rather than just like, hey, actually know what you're talking about. Don't make fun of the culture.
I think like the older a thing is, the more license you have to pastiche.
Yeah.
So like, looking back at ancient Egypt and ancienter Egypt, you have a lot of room for humor there because you're probably not going to be directly offending anybody from cultures that are connected to that.
Right.
You might offend somebody who has like a great deal of personal respect for those eras or whose like area of study is those eras.
Right.
But unless you're playing a role-playing game with somebody who has a PhD in ancient Egyptian history, you're probably not going to be offending anybody.
Yeah.
The closer you get to our time and the more clearly the lines become drawn to systems of oppression, the more careful you have to be.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you're going to be playing a game, even in like the Incan Empire or the Mayan Empire, those are close enough to modern systems of oppression that you really have to do your homework.
Yeah.
You really have to understand the cultural impact that those times are going to have on people today.
Yeah.
Let alone if you go into something crazy, if you want to play a game that's set in the antebellum South, there is going to have to, one, be a really crazy session zero on that.
Oh, two, yeah.
So much respect is going to have to be paid to that time and that era and the struggles of the people who have come out of that and their descendants.
Well, and it's right? Like, it becomes even more important in a setting like that to really make sure you are solid on why you want to use that setting. Just like you would with any fantasy setting, have a good reason to use a specific historical setting. Maybe there's like a really important concept that you want to explore. Make sure that using a historical setting is the best like way to do it. Because I think for safety's sake, if you can't be respectful, like if you can't be confident in the level of respect you're going to be giving, like just do it in fantasy and just, you know, just X-Men it up.
And you need to make sure that like your players are on board for the same level of respect.
Yeah.
Because like nothing is going to be worse than doing all of this research and respectfully approaching a subject in a time frame that is going to have a very real impact on people. And then having your like player show up with a character in blackface.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it's just not going to fly. And so you really want to make sure that everybody is on the same page for telling the type of story that you're looking to tell, and that everybody has bought into that setting and the story that you're looking to tell before even moving into like character creation.
Yeah.
So that would be kind of my guidelines for that. I do think that like anytime you're looking at something that is real people,
yep,
there is a level of respect that you kind of have to go into with it.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the things that I found weird about Shogun when they changed the names of so many of these people. Right. Like I get that that's what the author did for the book and that like there was a precedent there for some of the previous works that have been done for this, but like just call him Tokugawa.
Yeah.
put some respect on his fucking name. The guy did an incredible thing and absolutely should be remembered for it. Right. And like calling William Adams by Jack Blackthorne. Like, yeah, that's a cooler name. Well done. But
so I kind of actually support the changing of names because like he's not a historian. Like he's not right. actually documenting or like rewriting what actually happened in history. There's going to be some fictionalization. I would rather him just completely change the name and not like muddy the waters on what actually happened with Tokugawa. Right.
I guess, but at the same point, like what happened with Tokugawa was so interesting that
And his story deserves to be told, but like that it is it's fictionalized. Like it's not actual history. So if there's anything in there that isn't strictly what we already know written from actual history, like, I don't know, dialogues and monologues and stuff like that, like, yeah, change the names, because Tokugawa didn't say that stuff.
No, that's fair.
You know?
I just, like, and I get that it is historical fiction.
Yeah.
I just worry that something that is broadly broadcast to people like this is going to have an impact on some people's understanding of what actually happened during that era.
Yeah.
And like a lot of it is quite historically accurate. Like there's some things that bother me. Don't get me wrong. The fact that like messenger pigeons are used extensively in the show.
Sure.
Me fucking batty. But that's just me and I'm a dweeb. But like I'm worried that by looking at what happened for the Toranaga shogunate that didn't exist, they have inadvertently muddied those waters further.
Yeah. Okay. I see your point. I don't know. I still just like I'm fine with fake names. Just okay. If you're telling a cool story that's roughly historical and not like actual history, that I think that's the safer move.
So when we're playing in our first century Christian role-playing game, you're cool with me renaming Jesus Jeremy? Just Jeremy Christ did the walking on the water? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
No, you could use his real name. Yeshua Ben David.
Ben Yosef? Is it Ben David?
Pretty sure it's Ben David.
I thought it was Ben Yosef.
There, let's double check.
I'm not a biblical scholar, though.
I'm pretty sure it was Ben David. Let's see. Jesus' real name was Yeshua. Full name. Whatever. This is not that important to me, but...
But nah. For some riveting listening. That's some
plus
content.
Listening
to Josh looking up Jesus Christ's real name.
Well, okay. In my defense, it's Josh looking up Jesus' real name, which is Josh. So.
Yes.
also, yeah.
Johan?
No, it would be Ben David because he was of the house of David, which is why he had to go to Bethlehem. So there.
Right.
Ha.
All right. think I was watching something about the Green Brothers, like the Vlog Brothers, and they were trying to figure out like the origins of their names, and their names are John and Hank, and Hank is actually a diminutive of Johan.
Johan.
So where John comes from.
So their names are John and John Green.
Their names are John and John Green, which were both from Yeshua as well. So their names are both Yeshua and Yeshua Green.
So the Green brothers are Josh and Josh Green.
Yes.
You know, I've had enough trouble in my life given that Josh was the most popular boy's name in my birth year of being like lost in a crowd of just Joshes everywhere. This is just getting worse when every name is descended from Josh.
My name is the third most common in my year, right after I think Michael and John.
Yeah.
And my mom blessed me with spelling it funny. So like I have a name that's easy to like say and remember, but I have to spell it for literally everyone.
Good.
Yeah.
Make life more difficult for just you.
Just me. Yeah. Danish spelling. Goddamn. Anyway, I don't know. I'm kind of two minds about changing historical names. I mean, a lot of the times you're just not going to know.
Yeah.
Like, depending on the era that you've chosen for a thing, if you're out in the Wild West doing a thing with a bunch of cowboys, then you can name your people whatever the hell you want, because who knows what anybody's real name was there. Or if you're involving yourself in the politics of, like, 13th century Thailand, which I'm not...
Yeah.
Saying is actually a real place. I don't know the history of Thailand.
0%, yeah.
Like, nothing. I know absolutely nothing about the history of Thailand. And I'm going to educate myself on that immediately after we're done recording. But, like, if you're setting something in an era that you don't know anything about and that none of your players know anything about, then you're probably cool just to make up whatever names you want.
Yeah.
But if people are expecting to meet Queen Elizabeth, you don't want to change your name.
Yeah. That's kind of important.
Yeah. Or Abraham Lincoln. Or whatever.
I guess it kind of comes down to, like, if you're telling a story about a historical person, then, like, maybe it's important to change their name if you're, like, animating them, if that makes sense. Mm. But if you're just having a historical person tangential to your setting because they are important to that setting, then yeah, you need to like reestablish it. Yeah, that's them. That's the real one. Because otherwise it doesn't really mean anything, right? Like otherwise you're just playing a setting in the Old West and Abraham Lincoln.
I was just thinking that it would be kind of fun to put together like a campaign where time travel is fraught.
Yeah.
Peril, but like the idea of going back in time and saving Abraham Lincoln,
yeah,
sounds like a lot of fun to me, because like you got to save Abraham Lincoln, but you can't butterfly effect anything else.
Yeah,
or like you need to save Abraham Lincoln from like a previous assassination attempt so that he's ready to be assassinated by John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah,
that could be fun. Probably not gonna do it.
No,
it'd be fun,
but still fun idea.
Hey, thanks for making it all the way through this episode of No Plot Only Lore. If you're looking for more, you can always find us at noplotonlylore.com and on all the very best podcast platforms. If you like what you heard today, please share, rate, and review the show to feed my never-ending need for attention and validation.